Chapter 8. The Khmer, 802 to 1431. In the year 1913, the French writer and explorer Georges Grolier journeyed down the Mekong River in what is today Cambodia. Grolier was a painter, an architect, a photographer, and a historian. He had spent time living among Cambodia's Khmer people and learned their language, and his account of his travels gives one of the most vivid and evocative descriptions of the country. It is low water, the river's time of great poetry, with the steep banks cut sheer in the fleshy red earth. All the trees there grow vigorously. There are teaks with broad leaves of tender green, sugar palms and their fruit, bamboos like spurts of water, green and slender at bottom, tumbling up top with a delicate flourish, huge banyans sheltering pagodas, black mangoes. There are bony white cadavers of great trees, their twisted branches gesturing desperately at the passing waters. But of all the sights that Grolier saw, the one that most impressed him was the ruined temples of the ancient city of Angkor. "I saw the great stone lotus rise above a sea of treetops," he writes. "I have just seen Angkor Wat, temple of the royal city. I had awaited the most advantageous hour when the sun is low and about to vanish. The mass took on a grey-green hue so fine that the stone attained a vague transparency. The great bamboos to the sides were doubled in the still waters of the moats. Oxen passed by, and beyond all that, at the centre of the immense horizontal line of galleries on the first foundations, above motionless palms and rising shadows, the staggering mass and its five conical towers bathed in sunlight." Of all the ruined sites of the world, few have captured the imaginations of travellers as completely as the remains of the Khmer Empire, a power that ruled a large part of Southeast Asia from the 9th to the 15th century, and covered much of Cambodia and Thailand, and parts of Vietnam and Laos. At the heart of this empire was the megacity of Angkor. Satellite imaging has revealed that during its peak in the 11th to 13th centuries, this city covered an area of over 1,000 square kilometers, larger than New York City today. And its wider agricultural area is thought to have supported at least 1 million people, or 0.25% of the world's population at the time. But by the middle of the 15th century, the entire city had been abandoned, left to crumble and be devoured by the voracious roots of banyans and silk cotton trees. Since the first Western explorers encountered the ruins of Angkor at the end of the 16th century, its very existence, like the ruins of the classic Maya, had upset Europe's notion of itself. Just as in Yucatan, many Western writers found themselves scrambling for an explanation for how such an impressive city could have been built in Cambodia, one of which was proposed by Marcelo de Ribadeneira in 1601. "There are the ruins of an ancient city there which some say was built by Alexander the Great or the Romans. It is amazing that no one lives there now. It is inhabited by ferocious animals, and the local people say it was built by foreigners." One later writer even argued that this city must have been the work of the Roman Emperor Trajan, without explaining quite how he might have got there. In fact, virtually nobody in Europe gave credit to those who had actually built these temples, the people of Cambodia, who called themselves the Khmer. The Khmer are one of the oldest ethnic groups of Southeast Asia. They arrived in the region over 4,000 years ago, probably from southern China, and were some of the earliest people in the world to use bronze and to theorize the number zero in their mathematics. For much of their early history, the Khmer were ruled over by others, An empire known as Chen La had once ruled the lands of Cambodia. But following its collapse, the region broke up into a set of small Khmer kingdoms, which seemed to have come under the sway of a foreign empire, known in the inscriptions as Java, thought not to be the Indonesian island, but instead the Cham people of southern Vietnam. The Cham ran a powerful trading empire that could muster fleets of ships with dragon-headed prows to crush any resistance to their rule. The beginning of the Khmer Empire is conventionally dated to the year 802 CE, when a revolutionary warrior led an uprising against the Cham and crowned himself king of all the Khmer. He gave himself the name Jayavarman II, after the last king of Chen La, a signal that he intended to restore the power and glory of the kings of old. Many of the remaining Khmer kingdoms still remained loyal to the Cham, and so in order to convince them to join him, Jayavarman devised an elaborate and mystical coronation rite. The most valuable inscription concerning this ritual is dated to 1052 CE, 2 centuries after his death, carved into the temple of Sodok Kak Tom in present-day Thailand. Then His Majesty Parameshvara, a posthumous name for Jayavarman II, went on to reign at Mahendraparvata. Then a Brahmin priest named Hiranyadharma, wise in Siddhi, magic power, came from Janapada, for His Majesty Parameshvara had invited him to conduct a ritual so that Kambujadesa, Cambodia, would not be dependent anymore on Java, and that he would be a sovereign Chakravartin, universal king. This Hindu ceremony was known as the Devaraja, or God-King ritual. We don't know exactly what it involved, but from similar rituals in India, we can imagine perhaps an animal sacrifice, along with the burning of sacred kusha grass and incense, and the chanting of incantations in Sanskrit. However it was done, by the time the ritual was finished, Jayavarman had established himself, not just as king of the Khmer, but as a kind of deity. When the remaining kingdoms of the Khmer heard that a god-king had been crowned, their will to resist dissolved. Through a cunning program of military campaigns, alliances, marriages, and land grants, Jayavarman achieved the previously unthinkable. A unification of Cambodia that stretched from the northern border with China to the ocean in the south, with the old enemy of Champa pushed back into the east, and to the west, a place identified by a stone inscription as the land of cardamoms and mangoes, likely Myanmar or East India. His conquest complete, Jayavarman built a capital at a place he called Hariharalaya. He built the city on high ground, mirroring the cosmic image of Meru, the mountain home of the gods in Hindu belief. In view of the city, he built a vast reservoir, echoing the sea of milk that is supposed to surround Mount Meru. This construction must have been awe-inspiring for the people of the time, as he marshalled huge workforces to build embankments, drain swamps and dig ditches, and even diverted the course of the Siem Reap River, all testament to the king's divine status. But it would be Jayavarman's successors who would transform his kingdom into a true empire, and the grandeur of their constructions would reach heights that even he could never have imagined. Much of our story will take place on the shores of a freshwater lake called Tonle Sap, right in the center of Cambodia. For most of the year, the lake drains into the Mekong River, but when the monsoon season begins in June, the Mekong suddenly swells into a raging torrent, and the river reverses its flow, filling the lake until it resembles an inland sea. Today, villages around this lake are famous for their houses perched on top of stilts that raised them three stories into the air, clearing the monsoon waters, which can raise up to 10 meters. But the challenges that the Great Lake presented to ancient people were offset by incredible benefits. Thanks to the mineral-rich sediment carried into the lake by the annual floods, Tonle Sap has one of the highest concentrations of freshwater fish in the world, including enormous species like the Mekong giant catfish, which can grow to a length of 3 meters. One 19th century European visitor to the lake wrote that the fish are so incredibly abundant that when the water is high, they are actually crushed under the boats, and the play of oars is frequently impeded by them. The Khmer people also cultivated rice, first domesticated in the Yangtze River Basin from marsh grasses that grow in swampy ground. Cultivation of this crop requires turning the landscape into a series of artificial wetlands, and for this reason, the Khmer soon became experts in the control of water. Thanks to these natural resources and expertise, the nascent Lakeshore Kingdom would grow rapidly in size and grandeur. Every king who followed Jayavarman II would undertake the same ritual of the Devaraja, to crown themselves God-King of Cambodia. For much of Angkor's history, its king was both the wielder of executive power and the center of an opulent religious cult emanating from the temples of its capital. The Hindu religion, originating in India, had a long history in Southeast Asia, and Cambodia at this time was what's known as an Indianized kingdom, one influenced culturally, religiously, and linguistically by the subcontinent. An ancient Khmer folktale tells the story of how the lands of Cambodia were founded by an Indian prince named Kaundinya, who is called by a mysterious voice to journey to the land of gold, where he would become king. When he reaches this land of gold, he is attacked by a fierce serpent woman named Nagisoma, who he defeats in single combat. Kaundinya spares her life, and she offers her hand in marriage. In celebration, Kaundinya throws his golden lance at the coast and resolves there to build a city of gold, which he gives the name Kambuja, or Cambodia. The myth of Kaundinya illustrates the influence that Indian culture exerted on the lands of Southeast Asia. During the first millennium, peoples like the Khmer adopted India's hierarchical social structure based on caste, its Hindu myths and philosophies, and perhaps most importantly, the language of Sanskrit. Once a living language of North India, by this time classical Sanskrit was no longer spoken by ordinary people, but had become a language of scholarship and religion, used among the elite of Southeast Asia. Just like Greek and Latin were once required learning among Europe's nobility. But it's important to note that while the elites of Angkor were enraptured with Sanskrit and Hinduism, many of the common people of Cambodia were not Hindu. They were either Buddhist or followed their own ancient folk rituals that asked favors of the spirits who lived in the trees and the mountains. This division between the culture of the wealthy Hindu nobles and the beliefs of the common people would always form a stress line across Cambodian society. The Khmer king who would build the first great city at the site of Angkor was a man named Yashovarman, who came to the throne in 889 CE. While we might take with a pinch of salt Yashovarman's own inscriptions, which refer to him as a lion man, who tore at the enemy with the claws of his grandeur, it is clear that he met with some success, and he certainly had a passion for building. In just the first year of his reign, he built over 100 monasteries across the kingdom. He ruled for another 20 years, and during this time he built a whole new capital. Susceptible as ever to flattery, he named this city Yashodharapura, after himself, But today we know it by a name derived from the Sanskrit word Nagara, meaning simply the city, Angkor. In some traditions, Yashovarman went by another name, the Leper King. Leprosy, which can cause horrible deformities and skin lesions, was one of the most feared diseases right across the ancient world, and kings were just as vulnerable as anyone else. Today, a statue of the god Yama in Angkor has become a kind of shrine to Yashovarman. Eaten away by moss and discoloured by rain, in the popular imagination it has come to represent the harrowed flesh of the leper king. Perhaps as his symptoms worsened and he felt the certainty of his own death draw closer, Yashovarman felt an ever greater need to leave his mark on the world. And this explains his mania for building. Whatever the truth of this legend, we know that from the foundations laid by Yashovarman, Angkor's empire grew and flourished until it was the most powerful in Southeast Asia. There were a number of factors behind this success story. The first of these was the ruler's status as God King, which since the days of Jayavarman II had cemented his royal authority and allowed the peasants of Angkor to see service to their king as a kind of religious devotion. The second was the empire's efficient and decentralized tax system, which was administered through the religious establishment. Each village in the Khmer Empire had its own temple, which was both a religious building and an administrative center. These temples were each run by a powerful family, who would collect taxes from the locals in order to support their own lands, to pay their laborers and soldiers, and to maintain their own luxurious lifestyles. Anything left over would be funneled back to the royal treasury in Angkor. The status of these families depended on how much money they could send to the king, and so they competed bitterly, working as fast as they could to clear forest for new farmland and rice paddies, which soon covered the whole of the fertile central lowlands. This simple but effective system led to a swift expansion of the empire's economic capacity. The final factor in the Khmer's success was their skill at water management. As Angkor's numbers swelled to deal with increased demand for rice, its people developed an ingenious system of water control that turned their capital into what has been called a hydraulic city. If you were to fly over ancient Angkor at its height in the 14th century, you would see the land below etched out in remarkably regular lines, like a circuit board. These were the canals and inlets that allowed water to flow around the whole city in a circulatory system, inundating its fields and providing water for drinking, washing, and bathing. The Khmer built complex junctions into their waterways, using canals with multiple bends when they wanted a steady flow of water, and long straight channels when they wanted a fast, direct flow into the reservoirs. As water drained from the Kulen Hills in the north, it was channeled into two enormous reservoirs, known as barais. These were the largest hand-dug reservoirs ever built, with the largest capable of holding 48 million cubic meters of water. The largest of these, the West Barai, is roughly the size of 2,000 football pitches. To this day, their distinctive pattern is one of the most readily visible human constructions from space. Instead of digging down to make these reservoirs, the ancient engineers heaped up enormous mounds of earth into banks, in places as much as 100 meters wide and 10 meters tall, and diverted rivers and canals to fill them. These reservoirs had a dual function. They acted as overflow tanks in the monsoon season, preventing the rice fields from flooding in an uncontrolled way. And they also allowed the Khmer to store water for the long months when little rain fell. Angkor's water system was so vast and complex that many of its components are still a mystery to us. But it allowed the Khmer to harvest rice all year round. Soon the city of Angkor boomed to unprecedented size. Angkor, at its height, was the largest pre-industrial city, with a population 40 times larger than that of 12th century London. Like a modern city, Angkor was divided into a grid of regular city blocks, but every empty plot of land would also have been given over to farmland, which shared space with temples and administrative buildings. Much of this low-density city would have had the feel of an enormous village, where workers waded through the flooded rice fields back to their stilted houses, and water buffalo bathed in the canals. A traveller or pilgrim arriving at Angkor during the rainy season might have sheltered beneath the canopy of a roadside rest stop and warmed their hands by the fires, heard the chanting of monks in the temples nearby, the sound of bells, and the smells of incense and animals. These three pillars, the divine power of the God-King, taxation that incentivized growth, and their ingenious water management, supported the Khmer to build and flourish for over 400 years. But for each of Angkor's strengths, it had a corresponding weakness. Each of these pillars contained a fatal crack. First, while its king was powerful, his power depended on his religious status. Any shift in religion could undermine his royal authority. Second, while Angkor's tax system promoted growth, it also encouraged overexploitation of the land, including deforestation, and fostered resentment among the exhausted and overtaxed peasants. And finally, the Khmer's greatest strength, their incredible skill at water management, also had the potential to become their greatest weakness. The water network that laced the city of Angkor and the whole of Cambodia at this time would have required a huge amount of labor-intensive maintenance to repair damaged banks and inlets, and to clear the canals of accumulated silt. Angkor's water system was so complicated that under sufficient stress, a single failure could cause a cascade effect, rippling through the whole network and bringing the world's largest city to its knees. All these factors would come into play as the Khmer Empire reached its height. As so often happens throughout history, the rise of one empire begins with the fall of another. To the north of the Khmer, China's Tang Dynasty had presided over a golden age that lasted nearly 300 years. But around the time of the leper king Yashovarman, the Tang Dynasty was entering a nosedive. Huge armies of bandits now ravaged China's countryside and sacked cities, smuggling valuable cargoes of salt and ambushing merchants. This period of chaos in China opened up an opportunity for the ambitious young empire of the Khmer. Kings like Yashovarman and his father expanded their territory inland, and the anarchy meant that merchants and traders looked to the golden towers of Angkor to provide security on the roads. By the 12th century, the Khmer had come to dominate the lands of Southeast Asia, and the magnificence of their architectural works testified to their power. The most famous of all Khmer monuments today is the sprawling temple complex of Angkor Wat, literally City Temple, built by the Khmer King Suryavarman II in the early 12th century. By some estimations, it is the largest religious structure ever built, four times larger than Vatican City. If the entire city of Angkor is taken into account, more stone was used in its construction than in all the pyramids of Egypt put together. Angkor Wat was built out of as many as 10 million sandstone blocks, each weighing up to 1.5 tons, and these are held together without mortar, shaped so perfectly that the gaps between the stones are often invisible. Like most Khmer temples, Angkor Wat is designed to represent mythical Mount Meru. Its 5-kilometer moat encloses 3 rectangular galleries, each raised above the next, and 5 towers designed to look like lotus buds about to bloom. What is also remarkable is the speed with which this edifice was thrown up. The medieval Khmer people built Angkor Wat in just under 37 years, while the Normans took centuries to complete many of their cathedrals. Despite his impressive constructions, King Suryavarman's reign was hardly a golden age. A low relief in the south gallery of Angkor Wat shows him riding into battle on the back of an elephant, and here he looks the perfect image of a warrior. His chest clad in armor, hordes of foot soldiers below, armed with spears and shields. This is obviously how the king wanted to be seen, but the reality was quite different. Suryavarman's appetite for warfare matched his architectural ambition, but he met with little luck on the battlefield. Throughout his reign, he had his sights set on the 2 coastal nations that made up the area of what is today Vietnam. One of these was Champa, which had once ruled over the disparate Khmer kingdoms. The other, the more northerly kingdom of Dai Viet. King Suryavarman embarked on 3 separate invasions of these Vietnamese kingdoms, each resulting in failure. In one memorable instance in 1128, he led a huge army of 20,000 soldiers against the Viet people. This large force was decisively defeated, and the king only just made it back to Angkor alive. All this warmongering for little benefit must have drained the state coffers and caused instability and resentment in the kingdom. After Suryavarman's death, without an heir, increasingly inept rulers vied for control of the weakened Khmer state, and it was amid all of this that Angkor Wat was finally completed. Today, its architectural grandeur has cemented his place in history as one of Cambodia's great kings, but it is a reputation that perhaps he did not entirely deserve. Civil wars, rebellions, and foreign invasions further weakened the Khmer state over the next 30 years, until its collapse must have seemed imminent. But in 1120, a prince was born who would change its fortunes for the better. This prince was one Jayavarman VII. From the various sculptures that depict him, we see a man with a broad, strong body and a large head covered with close-cropped hair. Unusually for a prince of Angkor, he was a devout Buddhist. His eyes are always closed in the statues, a half-smile of peaceful contemplation on his lips, but his broad jaw is also set in an expression of fierce determination. Little is known about the childhood of Jayavarman. He was the son of King Dharanindravarman II, but for unknown reasons, when his father the king died in 1160, the young Buddhist prince went into exile, whether voluntarily or not, in the lands of Champa, that old enemy of the Khmer. This may have been connected to the fact that Jayavarman's brother soon claimed the crown. But this brother had little talent for ruling. He was soon ousted by a rebel leader named Tribhuvanaditya, who ruled the kingdom for 10 years. This rebel was belligerent, and soon his insults drove the neighboring kingdom of Champa to invade. In his exile, Prince Jayavarman must have observed the Cham armies leaving for war, the phalanxes of spearmen with their bright shields, the trumpeting of the war elephants, the long ships driven by oarsmen leaving the port of Vijaya. By this time, the Khmer Empire had been weakened by decades of infighting, and the Cham armies defeated it easily. The Cham burned the city of Angkor to the ground and executed the rebel chief, Tribhuvanaditya. Now 50 years old, Jayavarman must have heard the news of his homeland's devastation with a heavy heart, and he resolved to return. When he arrived in Angkor in 1181, the desperate people greeted this Buddhist prince as their king, crowning him Jayavarman VII. As he sat on the throne in the capital, Jayavarman must still have been able to smell the smoke in the air. Angkor's buildings were burned, and the bodies of its people still lay in the streets. The Cham armies were still rampaging through his land, burning villages and terrorizing the hungry people, who now looked to him for protection. Perhaps it was this newfound responsibility that brought Jayavarman's Buddhist pacifism to an end. He ordered a great army to be gathered and drove the invaders from his lands. He now took revenge on the Cham people for their destruction of Angkor, and finally achieved what King Suryavarman had failed to do, seized the capital of Champa and dethroned their king. The Khmer Empire was now wider than it had ever been before. But when Jayavarman returned to his capital, he found it still in a state of destruction. He embarked on a building project that would have few equals in history and would turn the capital of the Khmer Empire into the envy of the world. This part of Angkor is known today as Angkor Thom, or the Great City, a fortified complex combining palaces, administrative buildings, and grand temples. This new citadel was an engineering marvel, a perfect square of mathematical precision, surrounded by a moat, enclosing an area of 9 square kilometers. Carvings in the Bayon Temple in Angkor Thom give us a glimpse of the frenzy of construction work that went on. The city must have been wrapped in bamboo scaffolding as far as the eye could see, with the sounds of hammers and chisels napping away at the stones, and the huffing of work elephants carrying their loads of stone through the streets. Workers lived mostly on a simple diet of rice and fermented fish paste, and used only ropes and manpower to heave enormous stone lintels and pillars into place. Jayavarman undertook an extensive public works program too, building roads that connected every one of Cambodia's towns. The rebuilding project swelled the population of Angkor and supercharged the kingdom's economic growth. Jayavarman was significant for one other reason. He was not the first Buddhist king of Cambodia, but he was the first to declare Buddhism the state religion. And from the moment of his coronation, he sought to convert Angkor's society from their Indianized Hindu culture to one that was entirely Buddhist. Before 1200, art in the temples of Angkor mostly portrayed scenes from the Hindu pantheon, such as Vishnu reclining on a lotus leaf. Afterward, scenes from the Buddhist folktales, the Jatakas, and the life of the Buddha began to appear on the temples instead. Angkor Wat was slowly transformed into a center of worship, not for the Hindu god Vishnu as it was designed, but for the Buddha. It amounted to a cultural revolution that pervaded every level of Khmer society. Buddhism had always been a part of Angkor's society, but it was often treated as a nuisance. Like Christianity in the Roman Empire, when a liberal and tolerant ruler held power, its followers could go about more or less unmolested. But it took only one ruler with a particular dislike for the religion for things to turn nasty. Now, just as Christianity had in Rome, Buddhists began to take over the culture that had once persecuted them. Buddhism succeeded in Cambodia because it was inclusive and universal in its outreach, a religion of the common people rather than elites. Buddhist monks were recruited not only from noble and courtly circles, but also from among the peasant ranks. This inclusiveness was also reflected in its architecture. As part of his constructions at Angkor Thom, King Jayavarman VII built an enormous temple complex called the Bayon, and it was the first temple in Cambodia to be built without walls, emphasizing its openness to the public. However, the kingdom's conversion to Buddhism would have wide-reaching consequences that Jayavarman may not have anticipated. As a Buddhist, he renounced the title of God King, instead giving himself the humbler title, the Lord Who Looks Down. But he still retained the traditional power of the God Kings who had come before him, and presided over the construction of both Hindu temples and Buddhist image houses. This was possible because Jayavarman was a Mahayana Buddhist, a branch of Buddhism that was highly malleable and adaptive, as it spread out of India into Cambodia, Tibet, and China. It made accommodations with local customs and beliefs wherever it went. But in the century that followed Jayavarman's rule, the official religion would change from Buddhism to Hinduism and back again multiple times, depending on the beliefs of the ruler. This inconsistency seems to have led to a widespread erosion of people's faith in the state religion. The common people must have asked themselves, well, is the king a god or isn't he? Into this vacuum of trust swept a new hardline branch of Buddhism imported from Sri Lanka called Theravada. Theravada Buddhism was austere and uncompromising. Its monks lived in poverty, forbidden even to touch money. They wandered between villages on pilgrimages and lived only on what locals gave them to eat. For centuries, Khmer society had been a picture of feudal inequality. Khmer peasants paid taxes to the noble-run temples, worked the fields, and could be conscripted into work gangs whenever a new building project was underway. It's estimated that construction of the great reservoir of the West Barai, for instance, required the manpower of 200,000 peasants working for 3 years. Meanwhile, the king and his nobles, as well as the priests and holy men in the temples, used the peasants' taxes to fund lives of enormous luxury. The king's palace required the services of up to 4,000 palace women, while according to the inscriptions at just one medium-sized temple, it required a staff of nearly 13,000, including 600 dancers and 1,000 administrators. It's not hard to see how this new ascetic Buddhism, whose priests lived in grass huts among the villagers rather than in golden temples, became so popular among Cambodia's common people, or how dangerous it would soon become for the authority of the crown. By 1295, only 70 years after Jayavarman VII's death, the spread of Theravada Buddhism had caused the monarch to lose virtually all religious supremacy. For the next rulers of the empire, this would spell disaster. When Jayavarman VII died around the year 1220, he would have been close to 100 years old. The pipes and conches, the drums and gongs and flutes that sounded at his funeral would have been audible from great distances. The people of Angkor were mourning their king, but they may as well have been mourning for their whole society. From this point on, all monumental religious building projects in Angkor came to an end. Soon, virtually all building projects ground to a halt. Over the next 100 years, the creation of stone inscriptions in the capital would slow until they eventually stopped altogether, and would not resume again until the mid-16th century. Frustratingly for historians, these stone inscriptions are more or less the only source for what was going on in this kingdom at this time. The Khmer were a literate and scholarly people, but their books were written on strips of dried palm leaf, which were so delicate and perishable that not a single Angkor-era paper text has survived to this day. With the end of stone inscriptions, we're left guessing as to what exactly happened in those years. The last recorded king of Angkor was Jayavarman IX, who reigned from 1327 to 1336, before he was supposedly killed by his head gardener, who married his daughter and took his place on the throne. Just a hint of the kinds of chaos that seemed to have engulfed the royal court. For the next 200 years, not even the name of one king has survived. In 1296, the Mongol emperor Timur Khan, who sat on the dragon throne of China, sent an embassy to the Khmer Empire. One member of this mission was a man named Zhu Daguan, who spent a year in Angkor during this period and wrote a long report for the emperor on his return, which now stands as the only surviving eyewitness account of what life was like in the Khmer Empire. Zhu Daguan took detailed notes on everything he saw, from the stones carved into the shape of elephants to the clothing of the people, who all wear their hair wound up in a knot and go naked to the waist, wrapped only in a cloth, to the towering temples and the large numbers of monks he saw walking the streets. Despite the influence of the austere Theravada Buddhism, Zhu was also impressed by the magnificence that apparently still accompanied the Khmer king on his royal processions. Each time the king came out, all his soldiers were gathered in front of him, with people bearing banners, musicians and drummers following behind him. One contingent was made up of 300 to 500 women of the palace. They wore clothes with a floral design and flowers in their coiled up hair, and carried huge candles, alight even though it was daylight. All the ministers, officials and relatives of the king were in front, riding elephants. Their red parasols, too many to number, were visible in the distance. Last came the king, standing on an elephant, the golden sword in his hand and the tusks of the elephant encased in gold. Aside from the remaining royal pomp, markers of decline were already beginning to show beneath the surface of Khmer society and the signs of conflict. At one point, Zhu Daguan mentions that, as a result of repeated wars with the Siamese, the land has been completely laid to waste. In the past century, the Khmer had suffered the rise of a number of powerful rivals in the region. A kind of early globalization of commerce in Southeast Asia saw the rise of powerful coastal cities that began to eclipse the inland capital of Angkor as centers of trade. The Viet and Thai peoples had grown in strength and confidence and were putting pressure on the Khmer. Around the start of the 14th century, three maritime city-states on the lower Chao Phraya Valley in modern Thailand united to form a powerful confederacy. These would one day be known as the Kingdom of Ayutthaya. By 1350, this new power had gained enough confidence to challenge the great powers of the region, including the now weakened Khmer. In 1352, the Thai king Utong was sufficiently emboldened to make a strike at the capital itself. He marched a large army into Cambodia and encircled Angkor. The very features that made Angkor perfect for rice farming, its wide flat plains, made it a difficult city to defend in times of war. Some historians have also argued that the extensive system of roads built by Jayavarman VII, which had boosted the empire's economy in previous centuries, now worked against it, allowing its enemies to march across the territory at speed. Angkor fell in that first siege, and then for a period passed between Thai control and rebel Khmer kings. This chaos roiled for nearly a century, until the final decisive conflict in 1431, when the armies of Ayutthaya once again marched on Angkor, surrounded it, and laid siege. The Thai armies cut off the city's supplies on both the land and the canals. We can imagine the drums of war beating and the trumpeting of the elephants, the smoke rising from the siege camps as Angkor was slowly throttled of life. After 7 long months, the city fell, and the Thai forces sacked it completely. Statues from Angkor have been found decorating the Thai capital of Ayutthaya, suggesting an organized campaign to despoil the city. A Khmer prince soon chased away these Thai usurpers, but after this humiliation, Khmer kings could no longer rule from Angkor. They moved the king and his court south to a more defensible location, near where the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, is today. It was the end of the golden era of the Khmer Empire. Despite its loss of status, Angkor had recovered from the destruction of war in the past, and historians have struggled to explain why the city was abandoned in the years that followed. Some have argued that only a cataclysm like an earthquake or the arrival of bubonic plague can account for the city's ruin. But the archaeological record shows no signs of these disasters, and suggests that Angkor's decline was not a thunderclap. New scientific evidence, including analysis of sediment cores, shows that land use in the center of the city had reduced gradually for more than 100 years before its collapse. It's now thought that at least part of the story of the city's downturn may have been caused by shifts in the region's climate and the global transition from the medieval warm period to the Little Ice Age. Looking at the enormous canals to the south of Angkor, we see that around this time they became filled with a large amount of coarse-grained sand. This suggests a period of torrential rainfall and flooding, during which large silt deposits were swept down from the hills. But around the same time, the exit channels that usually drained water from the large reservoirs were deliberately blocked to conserve water. Some were narrowed, while others were turned into inlets to increase the water flowing into the lakes. This seems to point to a period of drought when the citizens were fighting to keep the reservoir levels high. The answer to this apparent paradox came in the recent publication of a study into the widths of tree rings in Cambodia, covering a period of nearly 1,000 years. Tree rings are wider in periods of heavy rainfall and thinner in years of low rainfall. And the study shows that around 1350, monsoon rainfall in Southeast Asia became incredibly variable. A 25-year period of severe droughts occurred from 1330 to 1375, and again from 1400 to 1425. Between these extreme dry periods, the rain fell in a deluge. On a planetary scale, the climate was fluctuating far more intensely in the period from the mid-14th to the early mid-16th century, writes the historian Roland Fletcher. By the 13th century, the infrastructure of Greater Angkor was huge, aging and intractable. Some parts of the water network were between 300 and 500 years old. In addition, the network was profoundly complex, convoluted, and full of redundancies and old superseded features. The Khmer were well prepared for droughts that lasted 1 or 2 years. But a nearly 30-year drought would have caused immense damage to this primarily agricultural economy. Desperate to irrigate their fields, the people would rush to adapt the drainage canals, running long, straight channels from the hills directly to the city so that more water could flow into the reservoirs and fields. Then the drought would come to an end, not with the usual monsoon rains, but with an unexpected deluge. The emergency inlets that had increased water flow during the drought would now become the city's downfall. Water would rush down them in greater volumes than the system was designed to withstand, and the reservoir would fill to bursting. The Khmer may have attempted to drain their reservoirs, but it would do no good. It must have been a terrifying sight as the water poured over the banks, turning streets into rivers and sweeping away the fragile wooden houses. The people of Angkor would once again work to re-engineer their water system, blocking the new inlet canals and widening the outlets to drain the reservoir, using a staggering amount of manpower and energy. But just when they had finished, the drought would return. This repeated cycle of drought and flood was a stress that Angkor's water system simply couldn't withstand. One bridge leading into the temple complex of Angkor Thom tells a chilling story. The bridge appears to have been hastily constructed out of building material recycled from nearby temples, with little of the refinement of nearby constructions. The fact that the Khmer people had to hastily construct this bridge shows that something had gone terribly wrong with their water control system. And the fact that they had to reuse stones from some of their most sacred and revered buildings shows that the situation was desperate. Judging by the damage done to the bridge, it seems that the Siem Reap River, which was supposed to run under it, carved a way around it, causing its entire eastern end to collapse. Angkor is an example of what's called a cascading systems failure. As Angkor diminished in relevance as an administrative and religious center, fewer resources would have been spent maintaining its water system, and the cycle of drought and flooding would have finally broken it completely. As larger parts of the city flooded, sewage and sanitation systems would have failed, and diseases like dysentery and cholera and malaria from mosquitoes thriving in stagnant water would have spread among the flooded streets. More people would have left, leaving even fewer to maintain its remaining systems. The onerous maintenance of the water system meant that Angkor essentially had a minimum possible population. Below that, the system would have failed utterly. The city would have flooded permanently, and life there would have become unlivable. Someone entering the city of Angkor in the latter half of the 15th century, a scavenger or a pilgrim to one of its faded temples, or just a fisherman on his way to the lake, would likely have found streets still flooded by the bursting of the city's great waterworks, overgrown with lilies and lotuses, and covered by the shade of the jungle canopy. "It is half light and half darkness, a greenish twilight," wrote one visitor, Malcolm MacDonald, in the 1950s. "A lifeless, haunted sort of illumination, such as might glimmer in a ghostly underworld." Soon after its abandonment, the seeds of the banyan and silk cotton trees would fall on the abandoned temples and palaces of Angkor. The control of these voracious plants must have represented much of the effort of maintaining these buildings in the previous centuries. But now they ran rampant. Their seedlings would sprout and put down their hanging roots like bunches of hair, which would then swell and harden into woody trunks. The banyans enveloped the temples and palaces, crushing stone walls beneath their weight, driving roots between stones and plucking apart the walls of the temples, cracking stone pillars like twigs. Today, the ruins of Angkor remind us of the dangers of the challenges our own societies face. They remind us of the threat that growing inequality poses to social cohesion, and the dangers posed by an increasingly variable and unpredictable global climate. We may hope that our existing systems are robust enough to withstand whatever climate change throws at us in the next century. But as the example of Angkor shows, this is something we may not be able to take for granted. In the 10th century temple of Pimmayanakas in Angkor, now crumbled and moss-covered in the midst of the forest, One inscription in Sanskrit and Khmer, called The Hymn to the Tree of Awakening, leaves us with a haunting prayer. King of the forest, endowed with blessings, you give refuge to all, O giver of fruits. Neither lightning bolts nor axe blades, neither gusts of wind nor pious flames, neither rogue kings nor angry elephants, may none drag you down to destruction. Blinking eyes, twitching brows, nightmares, unsettling thoughts. O sacred fig, appease them all, be they human or divine.